The recording that you're about to listen to is a talk from the City Bible Forum. We would appreciate you respecting our copyright by not making copies of this talk or altering the content in any way. We hope that you find the material beneficial. If you would like more information on the City Bible Forum, you can visit us on the web at citybibleforum.org.
Well, thank you. I'm pleased to be here. I enjoy the give and take on these occasions. And I'm ready to take a lot because I'm not going to answer the question I'm asking you. The paper you've got in front of you is obviously a used exercise, but it was not written by me. Don't blame me for it. It's a digest of a script that I gave at a conference, and I didn't do the digest, and I don't therefore endorse the balance of it and that kind of thing. A much fuller version of it, more extensive and very fully documented, is submitted for publication. And the negative reader, these things have to be peer-reviewed, as you know. And the negative critic amongst the peer reviewers denounced it for being smug and... something else I suddenly can't think of. Anyway, the smug was what got me, and I'm not denying it. Oh, I know what else it was. Preaching. That gives it away, doesn't it? The negative critic is, I suspect, an elderly, I use the word advisedly, an elderly secularist who is irritated by... people apparently pontificating on religious grounds, when of course we all agree these things should be kept private. One can hardly, as a follower of the gospel, disagree in one sense. It is a personal matter. So a great wall is established in the American Bill of Rights between church and state. A wall of separation. But I'm told that Jefferson, the great third president who was responsible for this clause, was doing it for a specific reason. I didn't invent this, it's what is known. It was to protect the independence of the Baptists that the wall of separation was established. A very important principle, not just for Baptists. So it was to hold the state back, not to imprison the independence of the churches. The critic, I'm quite certain, thinks that this paper is written by an 18-year-old. I don't mind that particularly, but I know he thinks that because he advised me to read one or two of the articles and just learn how to write a historical article. Well, I've done that and found it boring, actually. Where does the New Jerusalem come from? Well, it comes from the vision of John in the book of Revelation, and specifically, it's delivered by the mysterious figure in the vision, presumably Christ himself, though that's not said. But it's delivered to the Church of Philadelphia, a relatively remote city in Roman Asia. Nothing to do with Jerusalem, no stake in the old city. But he has promised a new Jerusalem. And where will it come from? It'll come from my God, says the figure in the vision. From my God will come a new Jerusalem. And where will it come from? It will come out of heaven, it says. And at the end of the book of Revelation, the new Jerusalem appears again. It comes down again from God out of heaven. But it displaces the old heavens and the old earth. And the old order of things, it says, will pass away, or has passed away. Behold, says the vision, I make all things new. Is not this ultra-modern? Do we not live under new heavens? We do. Everything that we know about this universe, above all about the heavens, is fundamentally and utterly and unimaginably transformed from whatever was known in the first century. The heavens are new. They are renewed every day by further extraordinary discoveries, particularly in these last few decades. The earth is new. It is not the planet we once lived on. In the year of my birth, for the first time, was promulgated the conception of the earth as fluid, in movement, the whole dynamic boiling mass of the interior, moving the continents slowly across the face of the globe, 2 or 3 centimetres a year, in the case of Australia, I think drifting slightly northwards. This seemed ridiculous, absurd, unimaginable at the beginning of my lifetime, but it has prevailed and been experimentally verified time and again. Nobody doubts that the Earth has been transformed in our lifetime into an entirely different phenomenon from what we once thought it was, a new heavens and a new earth. The paper, which you can digest later, argues that the intellectual prerequisites for approaching the phenomenon of absolute newness in our lifetime flows out ultimately from the doctrine of creation, and specifically under the trigger and impulse of the gospel, and the value systems, the intellectual value systems and fundamental presuppositions that we operate with, that have created, so it seems to us, this vast wave of innovation in our lifetime. This belongs to Jerusalem. What did Jesus himself mean? I've said this at the beginning of the paper under that awful picture, that smug picture looking at you on the piece of paper. See what Jesus says. There is a leaven. The kingdom of heaven is a leaven. Baking powder, if you like, which permeates unseen through the mass of dough, the stodgy mass, and makes it rise to something new, slowly, mysteriously, unpredictably, perhaps. That, says Jesus, is the kingdom of heaven. Well, as you know, it's not the only thing he said about the kingdom of heaven. But I'm speaking not just here dramatically. This is at the heart of what I'm trying to say. There is a sense in which this great innovation of all things in our history, culture, science, and so on flows out of the teaching of Christ. The paper argues this, and therefore the question is this indeed the new Jerusalem arriving in our time? And what on earth will the secularists make of it when they discover what they're doing? Secularism didn't start this way. A cyclum is the Latin word for a centennial, which you have once every 100 years. And it is not forward-looking. It is backward-looking. You have the centennial not to start anything new, but to recapitulate the old and renovate it Augustus himself is the prime example. He celebrated the Cyclum in 17 BC by banning adultery, making it a crime, by appealing through the poet Horace, whose extract I've given you there in the second column, to the youth of the land to marry and be prolific in offspring. We should try that on our contemporary secularists, perhaps. But the main point is that the cyclum is renewal, not transformation, not newness, but fortifying the old. Now turn that sheet over, and you find on the back of it two columns with mysterious numbers at the bottom, 5 and 6. I'm in the one numbered 5, and I thought I was halfway down it. Yes, no, a third of the way down. I've said there in that second paragraph on column numbered 5, in its currently popular sense, which I've not yet defined, secularism finds its ancient prototype in Julian. Now, Julian was a Christian by origin. He was the last descendant of the famous imperial house of Constantine, which had begun by establishing the church as a lawfully sanctioned, indeed privileged body, the establishment of Christendom, no less, in the relics of which we still live, and against which the secularists complain, rightly, in my view. But the model for this is the last of Constantine's house. As he grew up, being educated on the Bible, the experience of many people in our day, surely, being educated as a child, he memorized it. He knew it thoroughly, and he rejected it. He became more and more convinced as a student at university level. He was a fellow student with people who were to become great bishops in the Orthodox Church. He knew all about the magnificent achievements, intellectual achievements, of the Church in the 4th century. This is where we are. And the more he, although they were fellow students, he contested utterly their presuppositions and sought to revert totally to the old order of thought that had prevailed before Constantine. He was undoing the establishment of Christendom, the model secularist. And how did he do it? He did it by debarring Christian teachers from public schools. You think that might happen in our day? I do. Why? Because there are other schools where Christians can teach their own thing, are there not? Where did church schools come from? They came from Julian. He was the first person known to history to say the Christians ought to stick to their own schools. Invent schools for yourself, he said. Don't poison our schools with your false doctrine. What false doctrine? What Julian objected to was that the Christian teachers, the school system was full of Christian teachers, professors in the universities who were Christian and so on in the mid-4th century. But they are wrong, said Julian. Why? Because they do not believe the gods of Homer. You can't be educated in the ancient world except from the text of Homer. Your basic literacy at primary school for everybody was Homer, full of gods, whom the churches rejected. They did not seek church schools. They were not insulating themselves. They worked within an intellectual framework which they totally rejected, and they prevailed. They converted the Roman world en masse in the end by a superior and convincing view of the way the world works. And to be sent to private schools as Julian proposed, was the death knell for them. You can't learn Greek properly from the Bible. It's in the wrong sort of Greek anyway. Fortunately for the churches, Julian died within a year of this, and so the matter was quietly forgotten. But there is a prototype here, because the reason for Julian's powerful reaction against the churches is that he had been brought up in them. And much of the tenacity in popular secularist critique, the critiques, I'm simply meaning the critiques one sees in the newspaper, every time Cardinal Pell says something, or Archbishop Jensen says something, or any church does anything that impinges on public life, like contentious legislation that might or might not be before the parliaments, then the cry goes up. They have no business saying this in public. Let them stick to their own thing. There's nothing wrong with religion, provided you keep to your own terrain. It has nothing to do with the public era. This is, of course, the doctrine which flows from the Jeffersonian Bill of Rights, translated into our culture, intellectually, which, as I've already mentioned, was designed to preserve the independence of the churches. Fine, say the critics, be independent, but do it in private. In fact, the paradox is that we now love religion of the private kind, and particularly anything antiquated about religion, particularly if it's ethnically traditional and beautiful. There's no sense in criticizing it. No one would dream of criticizing the quaint, ancient, beloved rituals of any group in Australia, provided they are treated as beautiful museum pieces like that, and should be treasured, of course. So we have this tremendous paradox, part of the very contradiction that comes out of the gospel system, between customary, no doubt wrong, into intellectual terms, but nevertheless valued identity markers in an ethnic sense, and in the view of the secularists, the entirely illegitimate imposition on public debate of doctrinal arguments about how to behave and so on. So there is a true breakthrough of the modern secularist phenomenon here already in antiquity. At the bottom of that column, number 5, you see the great phenomenon of Augustine. Augustine was the most prolific and influential writer in classical Latin, just as Aristotle had been 1,000 years before, nearly, in Greek. And these two figures, Aristotle and Augustine, dominate to this day the study of the ancient world. More is written, year by year, in my disciplinary area, about Aristotle and Augustine than any other writer from antiquity. And what Aristotle embodies is the lost universe that we have all now rejected. A universe which is totally static, which is by definition perfect, and above all, eternal. The eternal universe, in which everything is right, ultimately, and all that goes wrong is a matter of imbalance or excess, and so on. And so the whole system of life, not just mentally, but the social order and private life, is regulated by high ideals of inherent perfection. Everything is orderly and beautiful, and above all, rational. It is logically necessary for it to be rational, in Aristotle's way of thinking. Logically necessary, we can say, I think, because the mind itself proceeds by logic, like we're doing now. We argue with each other rationally. And thus rationality itself is projected in Athens onto the key to ultimate reality. It's not true, and we don't think that anymore. Instead, we think like Augustine. And it's Augustine, above all, who has established the contemporary sense of the secular. He said, we live in two cities, not one. We live in the city of God and in the earthly city. And it's not a matter of church and state. The church members themselves, half of them, says, or implies Augustine, and indeed, what did Jesus say about the wheat and the tares? They grow together until the end. We are both individually in our own minds in a divided state. Half our minds operate in terms of a fixed order of things, half in the innovatory, revolutionary desire for change. That's the conflict of Athens and Jerusalem in our own minds, whether we're in church, whether we're church people or secularists. It makes no difference. All of us, because of the cultural mix we're in, operate in the two cities. It's actually better. If you think progress is good, all the great progress that has marked the West and which has become now overwhelmingly universal, it has come only out of the West, ultimately. All of this arises from the explosive tension in our minds between Athens and Jerusalem, contradictory interpretations of the world, which engender the dynamism of the West. That's my hypothesis. I've not copied that from anybody else. I'm waiting for the world to notice, tell people. Augustine said, however, you have to live this way, with conflicting obligations to the earthly city and to the city of God. This is the predicament the secularists are in, and we're all in, and so on. And it searches our hearts. Now, skip over to, things get tricky now. On the other sheet of paper, there's no numbers on one side. The side that has no numbers on it is the next side. And halfway down the first column, you'll see the reference to the first theme of contemporary secularists, and I call that the open universe. That is, the rejection of the Aristotelian doctrine. And I've laid out in this paper where the rejection came from. It was established precisely in the year AD 529. I explained that in the paper. Believe it or not, the very year in which modern law was established. That was the year of the Justinian Code. It was created in that same year. And in that same year, there's nothing except a coincidence here, but historians love coincidences. In the same year, for the first time, a Christian philosopher, working philosophically and not Christianly, refuted the eternity of the universe, proved it's not possible. So goodness knows. Law began and the modern universe began in AD 529. Nobody else knows that. I'm just telling you because that's what I've discovered. Sorry, I'm being smug. That's the first thing then. The universe was opened up, not in a hurry. It took another 1,000 years from the breakthrough, the rejection of the eternal universe, for the consequences to work out in the empirical science of modern times, which have unlocked the reality of the universe as we now understand it, that is decidedly not closed. The next column on that page, halfway down it, you'll see the second theme, which I call the open society. We owe that ultimately to those who were promised a new Jerusalem. Who were they? they were those who were losing their lives as martyrs, witnesses to the faith of Christ, because they would not conform to the demand of the Roman imperial power for support of the state cults. They refused, and they lost their lives for it. They did not blow anybody up. They were not suicidal. The suicide of martyrs was condemned. You could not be a martyr, nor can you, I may say, in Islam. The doctrine does not permit voluntary martyrdom. Martyrdom is valid only when you refuse the invalid claim that is made upon you as a matter of conscience. The Christian martyrs carried no sword. Jesus said, "Put down your sword," in the garden. They condemned military service as sinful. So they were totally pacifist. But it was their refusal which ultimately led to the acceptance that truth was open to alternative views. And ultimately, the Roman government itself, the greatest persecutor of them all, Galerius, on his deathbed, conceded for the first time in history toleration. Since it hasn't worked after 2.5 centuries trying to kill off the Christians, not on a big scale, but spasmodically, he gives up and simply formulates what we now all accept as fundamental to the open society, that one has to tolerate opposite ways of doing it, thinking and living alternatively. That comes out of the tenacity for the New Jerusalem. And finally, on the back of that sheet somewhere, halfway down the column that has a number 7 at the bottom, you'll see the third secularist theme, the open heart. This phrase, the open heart, comes out of the New Testament. Open your heart, says St. Paul. Why do you need an open heart? Because it's not obvious what's there. That's why we hate hypocrisy. Why do we hate hypocrisy? Because Jesus pointed out that what you see, the smug exterior, is not the truth. The truth about you is not seen by man. And St. Paul said, "I know what I want to do, but I do the opposite." He had not plumbed the secrets of his heart. We have not solved the mysteries of the open heart. The brain scientists are still trying to work out why we do the opposite from what we know we should do. The biblical view is it is because of radical evil. Everybody in our Western culture now, I think, accepts the notion, although it's impossible to define what evil is in secular terms, but the passion with which we react against what we consider to be wrong, whatever our views are, stems from this passionate hatred of hypocrisy which Jesus exposed, smugness. So, are the modern secular critics bringing in that secret kingdom of heaven through these open doors? Well, I'll just stop. I haven't got a clear answer to that. I'll just answer these in the order in which they were passed to me, and I'll be glad to take a few more if you want. The first is the anti-Christian stance of the Green political movement in part attributable to the notion that humanity's impact on the environment is seen to threaten the unending existence of the planet? Well, it's an interesting point. In spite of the fact that the ideology of our times insists upon the importance of change. There should be change at the political level and so on. No politician gets anywhere unless he proposes to change something. And the new is good in our culture. We all think the new is wonderful, except old-fashioned people like me who just want it to stay the same, you see, having got stuck in Jerusalem, not in Jerusalem, sorry, in Athens. So, but it is quaint about the... I may say I'm a passionate environmentalist in the sense that I hate to see trees cut down and all that kind of thing, and I don't disagree with the value system involved in protecting the planet at all. I think it's indeed, in biblical terms, the duty of humanity to care for it. But it's interesting about the this business of an implicit desire for the universe to be unchanging. There is such a desire. On evolutionary principles, for example, why try to stop the system evolving, which it's doing? I mean, isn't it all about the survival of the fittest? This is the evolutionary doctrine. I don't contest that. As a biological system, that is what is happening. And so why do we then keep wanting to curb it? It is, I think, subconsciously at any rate, clinging to the old fixed universe mentality. And we all cling, one way or another, at different points in our lives. We have this divided mind. So I'm not mocking other people. It's crystal clear that I belong to the old-fashioned hankering for the past type. I'm not denying that. But I'm trying to interpret the puzzles of our present predicament, and I think this question does put its finger upon a kind of hidden hunger for Athens. And I may say amongst philosophers, contemporary philosophers, very much an active back to Athenian virtue ethics movement is underway. The idea of so-called virtue ethics is a central topic now in contemporary philosophy, and they mean by that specifically out of the moral bludgeoning that came from the Jews, as Nietzsche said, the normative law from Sinai. Back to virtue, and virtue is the self-regulated, modified, moderate, good behavior. So it's not just sort of instinctual reversions that we have. In the philosophical movement, there's been this conscious movement back, and I may say at this very point, there's a reaction against that developing. I won't start you on that now. Next question. If Jesus Christ is the same today and yesterday and forever, what does that mean for things becoming new in Christ? Well, obviously, what the New Testament means to say is that Christ himself, by virtue of that title, is a person as defined in the 4th century, in the Trinitarian Godhead. And that is a distillation of what you find in one way or another in the Gospels and letters and so on. But viewed that way, obviously, Christ has formulated on scriptural basis in that systematic way part of the ultimate reality, which is outside the universe. This is the fundamental difference. In the Athenian thought, whatever was divine was inside the universe and shared the eternity of the universe and the materiality. The divine in Athens was a material phenomenon, very refined, of course. But under Genesis, God himself is entirely outside the universe which he created. It is his artifact. So Christ stands outside it. But the figure of Jesus confronts us here and now within it. Within our life, he is knowable. He speaks for his Father, as you know from the Gospels, and the renewal is our renewal individually, our inward renewal through trust in him as he searches our hearts. So, as Christ, if you like, he is the same yesterday, today, and forever. And particularly as Jesus the Saviour, he confronts us with inward renewal. Next question. Not a question, so I don't know how to handle it, but it says, openness to spirit of truth essential, testing of the spirit. The definition of truth, of course, is a great problem. It always has been, it was in antiquity. What do we mean by truth? But testing is also an important principle. It is the principle of actually finding out by examination, by looking at the actuality, the reality of things, what actually happens. That was rejected under the Athenian system. They knew about it. There were people called empiricists, but by and large they were rejected because it was not logical. To simply look at what was happening did not grasp the logical whole. So you had to interpret what you saw, that is mere observation, with reference to reality which was held to be beyond the observable, the logical reality, and you argued by analogy. And the analogical arguments from one thing to another, we can see now, often simply false. Because things look to be similar, they must be the same. Against that, the biblical culture itself promotes the principle of testing. God is forever putting Israel to the test, and they put him to the test. And we're told to test each other, not take things at face value. Test for truth. The next one. The Jewish rabbis had a view of the evil inclination of the heart. Was this present anywhere in Greco-Roman thought? No. The concept of evil is not available in Greco-Roman thought. What they deal with is error, not evil. Error means you've made a mistake. Above all, you went too far. Good people, for example, fell into error by being too successful. Success was a bad thing because it upset the balance of things. Nothing should go to an extreme, whether for good or bad. They knew about good and bad. They had these ideas, but not what might be called basic radical evil, which our culture now believes in. Who's going to say that X, Hitler, say, or whatever you hate, is not the very incarnation of evil? Who's willing to say it about himself in private, etc.? We have this powerful idea. It is not a philosophically analyzable idea. It's a kind of basic felt truth about our lived lives. And it comes only out of the Garden of Eden. That's where it begins. And streams down into our culture through that. So these are big questions, and of course endless little diversities. But what the rabbis are seizing, of course, is the classic Hebraic conception, which we hold to be the revelation of God himself, that there is a fundamental falling out between God and man. Next question, can you explain the difference between classical virtues and those of cardinal virtues? The cardinal virtues, which are listed here in this question, prudence, temperance, fortitude, and justice, they are the four cardinal virtues of Greek thought. Those words, prudence, temperance, fortitude, and justice, are Latin. But the Greeks themselves had the Greeks began it. Part of the logical structure of Greek thought was that there had to be four of everything. Let's not start on why. But because of that, there were four virtues, which they had their Greek names for. These are the Latin versions, and they're called cardinal virtues, and other ones are subordinate for them. So the answer is simple. Then it says, do they contradict? Well, the question doesn't contradict what. But they do, in my opinion, contradict the revelation from Jerusalem. They contradict it in spite of the fact that the church has baptized these cardinals. You can go to St. Andrew's Cathedral in this city for the St. John annual thing, if they still have it. They used to earlier on. And you'll be fine that you're praying in support of these as Christian virtues. This was a great achievement in late antiquity, a mistake in my view, in the coming to grips by the theologians in the first centuries of our era with Greek thought. They classified these things as Christian and added to them faith, hope, and charity, Paul's three great things. But Paul's three great things are not virtues. Faith isn't a virtue. It's a response. You're a trustworthy person. Charity isn't a virtue. It's a response to somebody in need. Hope isn't a virtue. Optimism is a virtue, if you like, but not hope. Hope is a response to a promise. So what Paul is describing is, if you like, a moral life which develops in response to other people, God or your neighbour or whatever it might be. And one shouldn't mix that with virtues. Virtues are properties of the soul in the Athenian system, qualities which you own, like courage or wisdom, prudence, all these things. They're your good things, and you should develop them. That's not what the Bible is talking about. Not in my opinion. I give up.
The recording that you have just listened to is from the City Bible Forum. For more information about City Bible Forum events in your city, or to order other talks, please visit citybibleforum.org.